We're at the Friends of Old Time Radio Convention talking with a legendary figure in the great radio days. He's Ray Erlenborn.
Glad you know how legendary it is? He's 83 years old.
No,
yeah.
You're not 83 years old. Well, then you must have been...
And would you believe I'm still doing this stuff?
You are. You're providing the sound effects for almost all of the reenactments here.
Well, yeah, all of them. All of them. I've got Bob Mott working with me, but the two of us are doing these 12 shows. One way or another, we'll get through it.
You thought you were supposed to be retired and not do this stuff anymore, right?
Well, you know, when I retired, I worked at CBS from 37 to 77. And I retired in 77 because I became 62 years old. Besides that, they stopped doing all of the big shows like Red Skelton, Carol Burnett, Sonny and Cher, and all those wonderful shows that they were doing, and I didn't want to stick around and do soap operas.
Were you doing sound effects for the television shows?
Oh, absolutely. Uh-huh. Yeah, from 1950. I moved over to Television City in 1950 and started out by doing comedy shows, one right after another. I did a few things like Escape and Playhouse 90 and a few things like that, but most of the time I did the Smothers Brothers and everybody that came along that was doing a comedy show, you know.
We have a great respect for television, but we have a reverence towards radio.
Yes.
And we want to talk with you mostly about your radio days. Now, early on, you started with CBS.
Yeah. I got signed up to work on staff in 1937. At KNX Radio, 6121 Sunset Boulevard, and I started. The first show I did with Bob Barker, who did Reunion of the States, and we did that at the remote. We were doing remotes all over town at all the theaters and whatever, but this was done at the Hollywood Women's Club, where I had been when they signed me up to work on staff. I was the master of ceremonies, and I wrote the Marco Dog and Cat Food Juvenile Review for 5 years. And then I went on staff at CBS.
But you went on staff as a sound effects technician?
Sound effects technician.
Now, what were your qualifications as far as CBS was concerned for being a sound effects man?
When I was a kid, I worked in vaudeville. I worked in silent movies. I worked and did club dates. I worked bar mitzvahs, whatever came along. And so I had a lot of show business background.
Ah, I see.
And that's why they hired me. And I had even done sound effects a few times. You know, I sang and played the ukulele and went around from station to station. And several times they would pat me on the shoulder and say, come into Studio A, we need you to help with the sound effects. So I had helped people like Charlie Forsythe, who was later the sound effects man on Lux Radio Theater.
He was
the only freelance man like that in town that did something like that. And, of course, they were at the Lux Radio Theater or the Vine Street Theater in Hollywood doing the Lux Radio Theater. And he had all of his own equipment, which he built himself. He had a drum that was 8 feet square that he would bring into the studio, and it had little lead pellets on wires that hung down, and when you'd hit it, the drum, why, they would go blah, 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 against the drum and sound like an avalanche or thunder crash or whatever he wanted to do. But he had his own equipment, and he moved it over to the Vine Street Theater, where they did Lux Radio Theater, and did the show all those years.
You didn't work on Lux.
I didn't work on that because he had that show.
And usually they were...
I did all the other, especially comedy shows. I did Al Pierce and his game. I did Joe Penner. I did Burns and Allen. I did Blondie. I did mostly comedy shows. However, I did a few like Edward G. Robinson's Big Town and shows of that nature as well. And, of course, that was done at the Wilshire E. Bell Theater. Joe Penner was done at the Figueroa Playhouse. We worked at the Hollywood Playhouse. We worked the El Capitan Theater. We worked all over town in these remotes. And the sound effects, of course, would have to be trucked from the studio over there and back every time we did a show.
Would they do it in the theaters to get a bigger audience than
big
the studios
audience.
Could accommodate?
Yeah, you see, in 1937, they decided they wanted a pool of star talent that was in Hollywood to work on the shows. So, you know, the Screen Guild Playhouse and all these big shows that used star talent. Mm-hmm. So they began moving these shows out here, and they had no place to put them because KNX just had the one audience theater there in the building. And so they leased theaters all over town to play these shows in.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the techniques that you would use as a sound effects man on a comedy show? I mean, each show probably had a little different approach to sounds. For example, on Blondie, I would guess that Dagwood is running out the door and he collides with the mailman, right? Mm-hmm. How would you achieve that effect?
By doing it practically. Yeah. However, we hooked it up and used a lot of Mickey Mouse effects. You know what that is? It's like they use in the cartoons. And when he'd go out the door, we'd blow the whiz whistle. Mm-hmm. Or when he fell, we'd use the slide whistle sliding down. Or we had peach baskets, you know, which were then made out of wood. They're made out of plastic now, and you can't find them. But we would crunch those when he would break his finger or whatever. And so we hooked it up and did Mickey Mouse effects on a lot of the comedy shows. And big crash. The thing that they wanted, the producers, the writers, and the directors, you'd ask them, now, was that all right? And he says, yeah, but make it bigger and louder and funnier. You know, so that all we had to do was keep working on an effect. Now, like a famous thing, like Fibber McGee's Closet. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. As you know, they would change that routine. We're going to do two Fibber McGee Closets in the convention here, recreations. And we've got a stepladder there, and we're going to pile stuff up on it and let it all fall down onto the floor, and ending up with a tinkle bell or a clang or some funny sound at the end of it. And they would always try to make it a little different every time they did it. Well, with the other comedy shows, they'd say, I want a big crash, but I want it different than anything you've done before, and blah, blah. So we kept working on things all the time to make everything louder and funnier.
Now, occasionally you would use recorded sounds, but that would be mostly for maybe an automobile running.
Background sounds, that's
like
right.
That.
Like a river, a waterfall, crowd noises, everything like that was on turntables. And we had what we called triple turntables with four pickup arms, so that if you were playing a three-minute record and it got to the end, you could pick up another arm and set it over on the beginning of the record and crossfade and bring it back in to run 6 minutes.
Wow.
And
keep
then
that going
we would
as long as it
use
was necessary.
Yellow wax pencils to find a groove if we wanted a thunder crash, and we'd slip start the record by putting a piece of paper between that and the turntable and then slide starting it and letting it go, and then we'd hear a thunder crash right on the cue that we wanted.
And all of the stuff done live on the spot.
On the spot, with rehearsals.
Yes, of course. You, the sound effects man, and in some case men on a show, you would have assistants.
Yes, we had as many as 6-7 guys on some shows. Like a Western show, the whole posse would have coconut shells and a box to do the horse's hooves in.
You were really another character in the script just about.
Because I did so many comedy shows, I would be called on to do voices. Now here, I'm doing a frog and I'm doing a cat, and I'm doing some character voices in some of these scripts. And so we also belonged to AFRA, which became later on AFTRA. Mm-hmm. And we belonged to the union and would get of what we call a vocal check for anything we did that was vocal. When I did I'll go to television. I did so much Skelton that Skelton had emphysema, and he was unable to do a lot of vocal things that, like the snore of the tramp, you know, Freddie the Freeloader. Well, I was his snore for 10 years to work at doing that show. And same way in radio. We had animals on phonograph, 78 RPMs, but they didn't do what the script wanted them to do most of the time.
Sure.
You know,
mm-hmm.
The dog would have a personality if it was on a comedy show, especially. So we started faking vocals, and I got to doing everything until finally I was hired to do all of the animal sounds on Dr. Doolittle, the film with Rex Harrison.
Oh, uh-huh.
So that I did all those animals except for the parrot, which was a girl, but that was a talking part, really,
uh-huh.
You know. Uh-huh. But I did the cats and the dogs and the fox and the mouse and all of those animals, the push-me-pull-you and the giant snail. I did the voices for all of those.
I would assume that any script that was given to you for a radio program had sounds in there that were required, but never gave you a gigantic problem because you had to deliver, but there must have been some that were tougher to provide than others.
It was what?
Tougher to provide those sounds than others.
Yes.
Anything that comes to mind?
You know, the more you do, the more you can do, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's like the animal sounds and stuff that we began by faking them, you
mm-hmm.
know, and doing them. But, of course, when you do them over and over, you keep finding ways to refine it. It's funny. Now, like, let me give you an example. You picture what it is you want to sound like.
Mm-hmm.
And when I did Dr. Doolittle, of course, we were watching a screen, and we actually saw the animals on the screen that I was doing the sound voice
mm-hmm.
for.
Mm-hmm.
So when you look up there and you see what the animal does, well, you come up with something after about 42 takes, maybe, you know, that sounds mm-hmm. just like what they want. And then they print take 22, you know, they pick out the one they like.
Sometimes the sound of an object is made by doing something different than what you might expect.
Oh, absolutely,
is that correct?
Yes. We used a lot. For instance, up here now, I've got two pieces of styrofoam. It's supposed to be somebody squeegeeing a piece of glass, and they wanted to hear the screech of it.
Mm-hmm.
So I rubbed the two pieces. Have you ever rubbed styrofoam cups together or anything
yeah,
to get
I remember
a squeak?
A little bit. Sure,
well,
yeah.
It gets a real squeaky, clean
mm-hmm.
sound. So we use that, and then we have a box of cornstarch that we bend back and forth for footsteps in the snow.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, we have the peach baskets that I told you about before that we use
yeah.
for crunches. And so we, yeah, we improvised with whatever we could find, and we spent a lot of time going to swap meets and garage sales,
mm-hmm.
picking up stuff to make sounds with.
Well, each time you had a new sound to be introduced in a program, it became part of your repertoire then.
It sometimes they became the signature of the show
uh-huh. mm-hmm.
and would be used every week, like a squeaky chair in Gunsmoke, you know,
mm-hmm.
the office chair that was in Gunsmoke. They had a squeaky chair that nobody touched because that belonged to the Gunsmoke.
Well, you were working for CBS at the time when they were doing Gunsmoke.
Oh, yes.
And Have Gun, and you worked on most of those shows?
No, I the only time I would work a show like that, because I was asked for so much on the comedy
mm-hmm.
shows,
mm-hmm.
would be when we had a longer vacation every few years because AFTRA negotiated
mm-hmm,
for us.
Mm-hmm.
And when somebody was on vacation, then I'd go and do Gunsmoke maybe for 4 or 5 weeks,
mm-hmm.
according to how much vacation the boy had that was on the show. So that's when I would do those type of shows, except for Big Town and Silver Theater, which were my regular
mm-hmm.
shows.
Mm-hmm. Who was the most demanding on the comedy shows? Which of those would have been the most demanding upon you as a sound effects person?
Well, I have to go back to television. Skelton was the
mm-hmm.
most demanding,
mm-hmm.
but I didn't do him in radio. For comedy effects, I think the most demanding was, it's between two or three, really. But Burns and Allen had a lot of effects, which were really part of the situation,
mm-hmm.
and you had to make it fit that situation. And so, on the Al Pierce show, however, I did a character who did travelogues, and mm-hmm. I would do the sound effects along with my monologue about the travelogue. And so I would do those. I did those for many weeks.
You would be doing the dialogue and then tossing
and
in the...
I would do the sound effects right along with it, yeah.
Did you do the knock on the door when he said, nobody home, I hope?
He had a podium that he worked on. It says, I hope on the front of it. And he would do his own knock because he would change it to fit whatever mood he was in. And so he did the knock, but outside of that, I did the sound effects.
If you had a chance to do it all over again, would you change it at all?
No.
No?
No, I started in doing vaudeville and things like that, which were a lot of fun. I loved on the stage. So when I retired, they were doing a lot of dinner theater and civic light operas, and that's why I have this hair on my face, because I did three different productions in different parts of the country of Showboat, Cap'n Handy.
Oh.
And then I did shows like Brigadoon, the old Scotsman in that, mm-hmm. and I did Music Man, Mayor Shin and the Music Man, and at that time they were doing a lot of those old shows and bringing them to the dinner theaters and the civic light operas. So I did 10 years of that, and then just about at the end of that time they started calling me for these conventions for old time radio. Mm-hmm. So they were going out anyway. The dinner theaters were closing, and they stopped doing stuff like that, and they would do stuff like Phantom of the Opera or something, you know, where there's no place for this type of character that I was doing. So I just kept going right on doing recreations, and I do them commercially. There's a California Artist Radio Theater by Peggy Weber, and I do her sound effects for those shows that she does.
Well, then you're keeping
you
right up with
it. You probably run some of those, do you?
They're not available to us in Chicago at this point yet, but hoping that we're going to get some of those, yeah.
Right.
So you're actively involved in that to this day.
Oh, well, you see. Now, from this one, I go to the Spurdvec Convention in Los Angeles. Yeah.
And you're based in Los Angeles, right?
Yeah.
Or out in
I live near Palm Springs. I'm in Yucca Valley. Excuse me.
So when you come out here to Newark, how much gear are you bringing with you?
I've got three cases full, and one of them is a...
Good.
Bless you. One of them is a Mackenzie machine that I play at. Five channels of tapes that fuse up, you know, that I can... So I can do... Mostly, I brought those for Superman.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
We're doing five Superman shows.
Not one, two, three, or four, but five.
Five. We're doing one in the morning, one in the afternoon, one in the morning, one in the afternoon. You know.
Well, I'm so happy that you're continuing to do this and to demonstrate at these conventions how these sound effects were put together and helping us.
Well, you can be happy about it. I'm amazed that I'm still doing it. Every time I get ready for one of these things, I say, now, what the heck am I still doing this for at 83 years old? Who needs it? You know, well,
but when you come to a convention like the Friends of Old Time Radio or Spurdvec, you find out who needs it, right? We find so many people who say, gee, this is
marvelous. In Seattle, they have a wonderful group up there. They're radio enthusiasts of
Puget Sound.
Puget Sound. And I may do Boston next year. I don't know. They called me and said to be ready, but they do that in May or something, I think.
I don't know. You know? I don't know. Well, we, you know, love to find you in Chicago sometime.
And, well, do you have an old-time radio club there in Chicago?
We don't have a club as such, but we have a very large listenership to the programs that we present the old-time radio shows.
I haven't even been there to see your museum.
Well, you have to come in sometime, you know.
Maybe we've got a radio museum,
that's
right?
That's right, and we broadcast our program from that
museum. Oh, is that what you do?
Every week, right? Uh-huh. Yeah. Ray Erlenburn, thanks very much for sharing
pleasure,
some moments
Chuck.
With us
Gee.
Today. Thank you.
And what was your name again?
Ellen.
Ellen. Happy to have met you, dear.
Thanks a lot, Ray.
Right.